There are so many people who come from a so-called colonial background who know everything there is to know about Britain and England and the kings and queens, and yet there's not a reciprocal feeling when they got here.
Motherland to me means Jamaica, directly, because I feel that's where my mum's from. My mum was born and brought up in Jamaica. I think, though, for my mum also, her motherland, she said, why, my motherland is where my mother come from, and that is Jamaica. That's what my mum would say.
You said he was your cousin, Obada!
You know, and that tune, because Lodi Coxon was playing it on his sound system, it was just thought that it was made in Jamaica.
Get Up, Stand Up Now, the podcast. Episode 1, Motherland. Put your hands down and your minds up. Listen up and glisten up. Exhibition curator, Zach Ovey.
Motherland really looks at arrival in many facets, right? And beyond just arrival, how we become British, the endorsement. How we actually make our mark within the language of British culture that's now here to stay.
Motherland, as in, you bring 10 questions, it's 9 times the answer. As in open-toe sandals, motherland. As in no clutching purses, no over-shoulder glances, no suspect eyes casting mans as vandals, motherland. As in, fit in if that's what you're wishing. This earth has a place for your roots, or wild out till your heart sparks, till your throat hurts. Be as loud as your best parts and watch the clouds part at the sound of your voice, motherland. As in, oh boy, my friend. Being either a term of endearment or the start of aggression, motherland. As in, your name is no alley in the dark. Cautious approach to the consonants like their sidestepping excrement. No, in everyone's mouths, your name is jacuzzi. Your name is fried chicken. It is welcome. It is engulfed. Ehiwema. Syllables are succulent. The vowels full of fiber. And at the end, a satisfactory... Motherland. Is where you taught you knew your name meant Spirit of God. 10 years older, lo and behold, it's actually my spirit is good. Swear down you were told different, as if you could ever know better.
Greetings. My name is Dennis Bovell, and I'm a musician. Well, when I was 10, I plagued my uncle, my mother's youngest brother, to teach me guitar. Because I grew up in a musical family where my granddad was the choir master of the church and my grandmother played the organ. So music was all around me, really. But I tended to lean towards the secular side. And my granddad wouldn't have it. He'd be like, nah, you can't play the devil's music in God's house. Right, which I had to respect. But my uncle had kind of broken the mold. And he'd bought himself electric guitar and went off to play in a band. Well, which meant, obviously, he had to not live at home anymore. Because Nan and Granddad wouldn't have had that in the house. And so I asked him to teach me to play the guitar. My dad had come in response to a call for people to work in the public sector. My dad came as a bus conductor. In the course of time, graduated to bus driver, and then he parted company with London Transport. He'd been doing night studies, and then became a British Telecoms engineer. My mother came to help build the NHS. 1960, she worked in hospitals all over London. She availed herself of all the nursing certificates. When she retired, she then worked for the Medical Council in Research, and at the age of 84, she's just chilled out at home now.
I hear a lot of admiration in your voice for her.
For my mum? Oh, yeah, you only get one of them. My dad got a job in 1958. 2 years later, he'd said, all right, I'm buying a house, get over here. So went to live at the house, because when she came, originally she was in a nursing home. And then they bought a house, and so they brought the kids over. So I was the first one to arrive, and they had a couple of kids here, and I came to meet my younger sisters. It was, and still is, racially hostile. But I managed to dance through the lines, as it were, to the point where when my own black brothers were saying, you don't hang with us, you hang with all them white guys, you know, you don't hang with us. And I was like, no, that's not, I hang with everybody. And then I started hanging with the black kids, and then the white kids were like, oh, you're hanging with them now, you're hanging with us. And I'm going, no, I hang with everybody. My school had a full orchestra and a recording studio. And I think it was one of the first in this country to boast that. We also had our own swimming pool, outdoor, not heated. So if you pissed the teachers off, they write two laps, you know, in the pool when it was, like, cold. I mean, if you were naughty, you say, all right, go take a dip, cool off, you know, and I had worked my way up by the time I was 15 to be trusted with the key to the recording studio. I'd met some other older boys. The older boys had said, you know, they were going to do this thing at school and that I was going to play bass. And they said, right, and the tunes are Otis Redding, My Girl, and Booker T and the MGs, Green Onions. And they was like, learn them and be at school tomorrow morning, 9 o'clock, and we're going to play them. And so I went home, record player on, learned the bass lines of those tunes, My Girl, do 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 do. And because I was the smallest in the band, they put me to stand on the grand piano in the assembly. So all the boys of my age were like, yeah, 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 yeah. Because I was like a younger boy who joined the ranks of the bigger boys and holding down the bass line. Now, by that time, my dad had allowed me to use the basement of the house as a recording studio, rehearsal room, general hangout for my friends, you know, because it satisfied him that I wasn't walking the streets and probably going to be stopped and searched by police and unfaired. Right? And it was before mobile phones, so I had to stay at home. My dad was a bus driver, so he would stop anywhere along the way and get in a phone box and phone home. And if I didn't answer that phone, that'd be it. So I was like, I was tagged. But I didn't mind because I was at home. All my friends could come there. We'd make as much noise as we like. You know, the neighbours never complained. Right? And, you know, the kids in the street would come to my house. You know, we'd have, like, jam parties in my basement. The first time we'd had any textbook at school that mentioned life in Africa, it was about the British Army's exploits in Nigeria. In that book, there was a character called Sergeant Gollop, and he was the sergeant in charge of the pay corps. And Sergeant Gollop had, for his girlfriend, an African woman, and her name was Matumbi. And I wrote it down and I thought, hey, that could be the name of my next group, Matumbi, because it was African enough. And then I researched the meaning of Matumbi and found that it was Yoruban. and it meant reborn. So Matumbi was born. There's quite a lot of reggae that has to be danced close up, right? So I went for trying to make that kind of music, and that's where later on came the groove of Lover's Rock, because it was music that you could dance close up, you know, and it was quite sexual, if I may say so. But here I was, being reborn into reggae. This is my new birth, reggae, because although my parents and their generation listened to a lot of that, us youngsters would rather have listened to Otis Redding and Jimi Hendrix, you know. But then when kids at school were going, reggae, how do you get that sound? How do you play that? What beat is that? Do you know what I mean? And it was a bit of a mystery. We thought, ah, we know the mystery. Let's play that. Boom, 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 ba, wah, 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 wah. Right, curly locks, you know. Now that I'm a dreadlocks, your daddy don't want you playing with me. Like that. Now, and then that, for me, was the birth of what we were starting to call Lover's Rock. It was the English sound.
Don't play shy.
My name is Margaret Busby. I'm the editor of an anthology called New Daughters of Africa. I was born in Ghana, and I came over to school in Britain when I was very young, and I was at boarding school in Westmorland. I was boarding school in Sussex, and then I went to London University. And while I was at university, I conceived the idea of founding a publishing company with somebody I'd met. And when we graduated, we founded a publishing company called Allison and Busby. I was born in Ghana, so was my mother, and so was my mother's mother. But my father was actually born in the West Indies. He was born in Barbados, grew up in Trinidad, won the Allen Scholarship, studied in Dublin, was a doctor in Walthamstow, and then migrated to Ghana in 1929. And my mother's father was born in Dominica, came to Britain in 1899 to study law, was a delegate at the first Pan-African Conference in London in 1900, and he migrated to Ghana in 1902. So the men come from the West Indies, but you never mind the men, we come from Ghana. Ghana was the first, sub-Saharan colony to gain independence in March 1957. So you know, there is that connection that goes back decades with Britain. You know, the British had forts, castles in Ghana, as did other Europeans, the Portuguese, the Dutch, Germans. And so there is a connection that goes back hundreds of years. There was certainly a feeling of pride about being Ghanaian, and Ghana was kind of leading the way, and people like George Padmore, very connected with Ghana, or with Kwame Nkrumah, the first president of Ghana. And there were even calypsos. There was a kitsch calypso about the independence of Ghana. I'll try and sing it. How did it go? Ghana, this lovely country. Anyway, you can find it. That was the... I was singing London, actually. That was the... See what's going through my head? That was the wrong song.
This day will never be forgotten. The 6th of March, 1957. When the Gold Coast successfully get your independence officially.
Ghana.
Ghana is the name.
Ghana.
We wish to proclaim...
Motherland to me, what comes to mind is Ghana, because I'm from a matrilineal tribe... Or people, the Fantis, who see themselves through the maternal line. So that, to me, is partly why I think of Ghana and Africa in general as the motherland. And it's where mother came from. And It is. It's the mother of all continents. It's the mother of everybody, actually. So I see that as the motherland. But again, Britain as the place where a lot of people in colonial times invested so much of their hopes and their expectations, because the mother country was where a lot of people aspired to be. They dedicated themselves to getting an education in Britain, or they helped Britain in terms of fighting and wars. In 1940, I found a cutting from a paper in 1940 where my father and three other West Indians on the Gold Coast were donating to England's war chest. You were connected to Britain in such a deep way that you thought you would defend Britain in times of war, which is why it was a shame when they came here that, as migrants answering a call to work here and rebuild Britain after the war, they were not treated as they expected it to be. Let me ask you to imagine this. Living far from you is a beloved relation whom you have never met, yet this relation is so dear akin she was known as mother. Your own mummy talks of mother all the time. Oh, mother is a beautiful woman, refined, manly, and cultured. Your daddy tells you, mother thinks of you as her children, like the Lord above the skies takes care of you from afar. There are many valorous stories told of her, which enthrall grown men as well as children. Her photographs are cherished, pinned on your own family album to be admired over and over. Your finest, your best, everything you have that is worthy is sent to mother as gifts, and on her birthday you sing song and party. Then one day you hear mother calling. She is troubled. She needs your help. Your mummy, your daddy say, go, leave home, leave familiar, leave love, travel seas with waves that swell about you as substantial as concrete buildings. Shiver, tire, hunger, for no sacrifice is too much to see you at mother's needy side. This surely is adventure. After all you have heard, can you imagine, can you believe, soon, soon you will meet mother? The filthy tramp that eventually greets you is she. Ragged, old and dusty as the long dead, mother has blackened eye, bad breath, and one lone tooth that waves in her head when she speaks. Can this be that fabled relation you heard so much of? This twisted, crooked, weary woman? This stinking, cantankerous hag? She offers you no comfort after your journey, no smile, no welcome. Yet she looks down at you through lordly eyes and says, who the bloody hell are you? That was a piece from Small Island by Andrea Levy, who sadly died earlier this year. And it was really her breakthrough book. Andrea's books were all exploring the connection between British history and Caribbean history, and specifically her own Jamaican history. Her father came over on the Windrush in 1948, and her mother followed. And it's trying to show that it's a shared history, that the history of post-war Britain connects with Caribbean history and Caribbean people. I mean, we were here because you were there, as people often say. I suppose all part of the so-called Windrush scandal, that the sort of the misreading of British history to kind of exclude or downplay the connection with places like the West Indies, as well as other parts of the world, other parts of the Commonwealth, including Africa.
They do a study on Norman. See, they find out exactly what go on inside this man's head.
My name is Norman Anderson, also known as Normski. Throughout my life, I have managed to be reasonably successful with, I said, the creative areas in music and photography. I used to phone up the magazines. I found out
You find out who the picture editor is, right? You make a list of their name, you get the telephone number, and you phone up. Stuart Bailey, the Irish journalist, he introduces me to the editor of Record Mirror. She looks up from her phone call and she goes, "Oh, hello, you're black." And I looked around, like, the room and my eyes, like, yeah. And that was because I'd spoken to her. And she didn't realise I was black because I don't have a black voice, maybe. Or maybe I have a white voice. I have a telephone voice. And when I speak on the telephone...
"My name's Norman Anderson. I'm a photographer. I was just wondering, can you put me through to the picture editor, please?" "Okay."
And, you know, this is how you do it. You know, the art of working your way through the door. Then you also have to, once you get a chance, you be nice to the person at reception all the time. Because if you're not nice to the person at reception, they're not going to get you through. You know, so you have to give time to all the right people because they are the ones that can press the button and say, "No, he's not in. Excuse me, I need to speak so-and-so." "What? Who are you? Who? Nah, that you're gone. You're out. And if they ever hear your voice again, they'll remember you from last time. Nah, I'm not taking a call. I've got no manners, whoever that is." So I learnt manners quick. Unfortunately, my real father, who's passed away now, he wasn't around for a lot of my younger years. But I had very supportive and very full family of uncles, aunties and many cousins, and have always brought back and shown me a lot of personality. That is the very basis of Norman. Nah, man! When I was about 10 years old, I think I was just kind of recovering from not being that well. And I think one of the things that my mum wanted to do was to try and cheer me up. So she had arranged for me to go to this auction with her. Talking about around about 1980, and one of the last things on the pile that was just, you know, it was dismal for me because I was going to get a bicycle. "I have this camera, full camera with a roll of film, includes a flash in a box, ready to go, Instamatic, Kodak. Do I hear? I'm not too sure how much my mum paid for it, but she did turn to me and says, "Oh, Norman, would you like a camera?" And I said, "Oh, all right then," really reluctantly. The photograph of my mum is a very poignant moment in my life. I love this photograph of mum because it's of her standing in her bedroom just before she's going to work. And obviously the look on her face is extremely proud, which is typical of my mum. I'm not sure whether it's because she is holding her original Jamaican passport. I'm not sure how and or why the passport is in the photograph. Did I suggest that? Or did she suggest it? It's very possible that I said, "Yes, get your passport." "No, it doesn't sound like me. Let me go get my passport." Why? I don't know. That's kind of really, that's her in her, she stands there proudly in her blouse, which is actually a uniform shirt, brush clippy. She's a conductress. And that was like, I don't know, like I said, that was like in the 80s, 80-something. She is a really proud Jamaican woman. You know, she come from a very proud Jamaican family. And she was the last in the line of the siblings to come over here. There's not like secrets, but it's a bit taboo subjects that people don't want to venture into. And, you know, I wasn't born in Jamaica. I missed that by a second. I was born in London to Jamaican parents and people I've met that are just a bit older than me. They were actually born in the Caribbean and then were brought here when they were young, like my mum. She wasn't brought here, though. She came here on her own. And she told me that she cried for a year because she missed her mum hard. She missed Jamaica hard. And this country was not easy at all. So if ever you wonder sometimes why some people have looked like they're a bit vexed, they left something special to come to this place. For my mum, that is her attachment to Jamaica, right there in her hand. That is her attachment. Having that Jamaican passport with a stamp in it that approves her to be in this country at that particular time. She gave me enough time to get the photograph done. And then she's like, "Right, I have to go work now. Go on!" If you were to get into mom's house, right, there's no wall space left. There's so many pictures on walls. Not just the photographs I've taken of my brother, the grandchildren, family members,
paintings. When you look at this oil painting, you know, so this is something like Van Gogh can sit down and rest himself. This is a serious painting in the gold gilded frame. My brother's got records that he's put out with gold disc and all this business. I got stuff. There's even pictures that have been taken off the wall just so they can see the wallpaper because there's too much pictures. But yeah, and there's this picture. This picture is up there, often flagged by a scarf for some reason, like it's some kind of hat peg. But I often take the scarf off. So what are you doing? Take that off there. But I'm very proud of that photograph. And like I said, you know, it's traveled way beyond my camera, man. It's been seen a lot. You know, when I speak to my stepfather, David, who's from Barbados, who's that a little bit older than mum, he tells me about, you know, when he worked on the plantation in Barbados, that was a really good job. That's where he learned most of his skills. And that's also, and then, you know, he went and the church, he used to love church because church used to do these trips on the weekends to different churches where you would learn different skills. That's where he learned to sew and handicraft and all this stuff, you know, and he would get out and see stuff. And see the other side of the island, you know, travel around and learn. You know, it's all about learning, which is why I think Mum and David have always been keen to let me just keep going. Go. That's life. You're learning, you're in, getting more information. You know, you're staying in one place and becoming more and more sad is really unhealthy. Really bad for everyone. Being in one place and being a happy person is good, you know, and supporting someone else to go. Hence why I keep saying to anyone, and I never did it, if you get an opportunity to go to the university, don't be a wussus. Take it and go. Go! Oh, I don't want to go. I'm going to be too far away from my family. Come out! That's the alarm. That was listening, man. That was like my alarm pan vibrates and didn't start. The man start drilling all. I think that was really, that was my motherland thing speech there, wasn't it?
This has been the Get Up, Stand Up Now podcast, Motherland. And you've been listening to the voices of Dennis Bovell, Margaret Busby, Nomsky, Zach Ovey, and me, Joshua Dehen. Thank you so much to Gaika, Dennis Bovell, and Trojan Records for the music. This has been a reduced listening production for Somerset House, and the producer was Femi Oriogun Williams. You can subscribe and hear other editions of the podcast on iTunes and all other major podcast platforms. Just search Somerset House on your podcast app. And if you're in London and you're listening before the 15th of September 2019, then make sure you check out the exhibition Get Up, Stand Up Now, curated by Zach Ovey for Somerset House.